Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 40. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Jeremiah Scott, guitarist of the band Demon Hunter. It has been my pleasure and honor to be the manager for Demon Hunter for about the last 15 years. Jeremiah joined the band officially in 2012, but has been part of our extended family for a lot longer. He's also the producer and engineer on all of the band's most recent records, going back to True Defiance, Extremist in 2014, Outlive in 2017, and 2019's War and Peace, two separate albums that were released on the same day, Use Your Illusion style. Jeremiah has also played with the Nashville thrash band Destroy, 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 and was part of one of the later lineups of The Showdown, together with Demon Hunter lead guitarist Patrick Judge and drummer Tim Yogi Watts. As a producer, he's worked with all of his own bands, as well as legendary Christian metal band Living Sacrifice, Further Seems Forever, the Tony Danza Tap Dance Extravaganza, and Project 86. Jeremiah is a consummate man's man who built his own home in rural Tennessee basically by hand over the last several years. He's also just a charming and good-natured, wonderful guy, a great husband, a great father to three beautiful children, and most of all, in my world, a very great friend. Jeremiah loves Metallica. I love Metallica. So guess what? I had him on Speak and Destroy to talk about Metallica. So here it is, my conversation with Jeremiah Scott of Demon Hunter. This is Speak and Destroy. A great place to start is, and one of the reasons why I'm excited about having you on here is, for all the years I've known you and as close of friends as we are, I'm going to find out things that I have never known. For example, what was the first music that turned you on to where you were like, okay, this music's going to be a big part of my life? You know, were your parents listening to stuff around the house, or, you know, where did that come from?
Yeah, my parents actually didn't. I don't know anybody else who can beat me on, you know, no music in the house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, okay, so all I remember my mom rocking was that Journey's Greatest Hits.
Nice.
She would play that when she's cleaning the house, and I think she just kind of played it just because we had that stereo, so might as well, you know? And then my dad, man, he's kind of like me. Driving down the road, he doesn't want to hear anything. No radio is what I'm saying. So he definitely didn't have any tapes or, you know, definitely not CDs back when I was a kid in the car. And just no radio. So we kind of just – I mean, I remember on long road trips it was just a CB radio so we could just listen to the truckers talk. And then whenever they ever got a little, you know, a little trashy, you know, my mom's like, all right, that's enough of that, and she'd shut it off. But
whenever they started talking about lot lizards or whatever.
Yeah, it was just like, so we really didn't have anything. Now, I've gone back and I've gotten my dad's vinyl records. And I'm like, man, Dad, you were into some cool stuff, you know, and I'm digging through. And he's got like, old Zeppelin records and stuff in there. And I just never heard it. They never really played it for me. But I did have an older brother. I'm sorry, not old brother, but an older sister and an uncle who is basically an older brother. So whenever I kind of started hitting like the 9 and 10 years old, Eric, you know, age, they were in the early teens and they were getting into stuff. So that's really what it was from. It wasn't from the parents.
Yeah, was this your dad's brother or your sister's brother?
So my mom.
Or sorry, your mom's.
Yeah.
I'm making it more complicated than it needs to be.
My mom's littlest brother, youngest brother, was born like 6 months before my sister. Okay, so my sister had an uncle that was 6 months older than her. Okay, so that's kind of how it works out. And my sister never my mom never really looked at my Uncle Mike as, you know, a little brother. Kind of looked at him more as like, another kid, you know.
Yeah.
And then he would come back and he would stay with us for summers. And then whenever he graduated high school, I was in junior high, and he came to live with us, just kind of like, you know, get out of his town and move to a different city. So really my formative years as a, you know, early teenager, I had this 19-year-old, kind of an older brother figure, basically sharing a room with me. And yeah, man, he really got me into a lot of this stuff. And that was, I didn't even realize there was anything other than what was on the radio. You know what I mean?
And, you know, that some of that's going to sound strange or complicated to some people in some parts of the world, but those of us who grew up in the American Midwest or the American South, it's not strange at all. I mean, I have a half sister who's almost 20 years older than me, and a half brother who's in there.
I didn't know somewhere. If you were referring to the part of my uncle being kind of an older brother, or if you're referring to the part of there was nothing other than just the radio.
Well, both actually. But,
like,
yeah,
they're both strange.
But
yeah,
but I meant the closeness where, you know, you can have an uncle that's closer in age to you, you know, more like a sibling. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, I grew up knowing people that had aunts and uncles that were younger than them. I had a lot of cousins who were more like aunts and uncles, you know, because generationally they were 10, 15, 20 years older than me. So it's like, even though we're cousins, like, you're almost more of an uncle or an aunt. Before we go too much further, I want to ask you, you mentioned your dad being like you. Are you still like that now when there's no wife or kids in the car? Do you want silence when you're driving?
Okay, no, I totally dig listening to music and podcasts and whatnot on the road. But I found out what it was, what I hated about listening to something in the car, and I discovered it. It can't be curated for me. It can't be a DJ. It can't be, you know, just some programming. I have to select it. So if, you know, whenever you got your CD booklet or your tape, you know, box of tapes, and you can play whatever you want, then I'm jamming all day in my vehicle. Like, it's always blasting. But as soon as you take the tape out and you're about to put in the next tape, and then there's the radio for a second, I cringe, and a little bit dies me every time. I just can't. I can't do that, man. And kind of same with TV. So I'm glad the way things are kind of going now, to where, you know, you got Spotify or Netflix. You can choose what you want to watch then and there.
I'm right there with you with TV. It's been several years now since I've, you know, I was kind of an early adapter with cord cutting. So, it's been a very long time since I've just turned on the TV and been like, let's see what's on. I mean, and you know, granted, I will go like, let me go, you know, look in Hulu, let me look in Netflix and find something to watch. But it's so much different than the days of just turning it on and the TV is just on.
Okay, so see how, you know, how you think that, and a lot of people agree, you know, with that. So take that and then go back to 1994, and that's how I was with radio. I was already tired of it being, you know, programmed for me. I could not stand the radio DJ going, "Hey, you're listening to," blah, 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 and then just start. Oh, it just killed me, and I couldn't listen to them. And then just commercials for days, and then you might hear two songs, and then whatever. So,
which all that being said, we do greatly appreciate all the radio DJs out there playing Demon Hunter.
yes, we do. But that's the beauty of, I'm going to pull my foot out of my mouth for a second and go ahead and cover that up. I'm going to say that's a difference with a metal DJ than
that's a good,
you
point.
Know, the top 40 rock that you're getting in Alvin, Texas in 1994. You know what I'm saying?
A huge difference. Totally. I mean, you could even argue that specialty radio is more in that category of what we were just talking about with Spotify and Netflix and stuff.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I can listen to radio personalities all day long if it's their personality or their podcast. And, you know, that's them. But those DJs in the 90s, we're just falling into whatever format. Whoever created that, I think one DJ told me that was it's called chucking, maybe. That the, hey, everybody, you know, there's a term for that.
Yeah, the term should definitely be like, yuck.
I think it's chucking. I mean, I really do.
Which sounds appropriate because it's got that like.
But they wanted, you know, it's like, oh, you have to do this to be on our, you know. Anyway, so it really turned me off. So I wouldn't want to listen to the radio. It really kind of just gives me anxiety. I could be listening to Top 40 radio and I'm about to just, you know, my nerves are on edge, my blood pressure's spiking. And then I could go, I can't stand this anymore. And I'll cut it off and I'll play death metal. And I'm like, and I just calm down. And I don't, that's weird, I know, but hey, man, I guess that's just a metalhead deep in his heart. I don't know.
It's not weird at all. I mean, I get what you mean about us, you know, having it sort of forcibly curated for you. And I think also, you know, our generation growing up, there were so many less choices. So if you were going to listen to the radio, you're still getting, you know, very specific playlists and, you know, certain things that make it into rotation. And it's really being, you know, it's like only having two different restaurants to eat from your whole life and, you know, with two menus.
Like, I mean, think back to you and discovering stuff. How many times did you discover something because you're listening to Top 40 radio? And then you hear something, you're like, oh man, that's a sound, or what is this? And it blows you away. Now go back to how many times did you have a friend drop something on your desk, or you know, someone play something in their car for you, and then, you know, it's just, you're gonna get, you know, you're gonna get deeper that way. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, now that you mention it, I can't remember discovering anything via mainstream radio.
I'll listen to Spotify now, and I'm listening to a record that I really like. And then this is something's happened to me a couple times recently. You know, you let the record kind of just end, and then something else starts playing.
And then Spotify's like, oh, well, you'll like this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so I think that whatever algorithm they're using is great, because I'm like, oh, I dig that. Oh, I already know what that is. Oh, that's cool. I mean, what is this? Like, and one out of every 10 songs, I'm like, yeah, skip. And then I'll skip it. But then recently, something kicked on, and I was like, dude, this is, like, rocking. What is this? This is amazing. And I go check it out, and it's an artist, you know, an album. I go, oh, cool. And then, like, 30 minutes later, a completely different song comes on, and I'm like, dude, what is this? And I go and looked. And it's the exact same artist and same record. So then I'm like, okay, now I'm kind of being inspired here. I'm being kind of impressed, blown away, you know. So I've had that happen a couple of times recently, and I can tell you what those were if you wanted or not. But I never had that with radio, I don't think.
Like you said, there's algorithms. I mean, it really is. And if I'm not mistaken, I think every time you're skipping one of those suggested songs, it's logging that too and figuring out more about you.
Oh, for sure. That's why I do it. Yeah, I'll be on a ladder installing a light fixture, and I'm like, oh, whatever this is, I hate it. And I'll climb down just to go hit skip.
Just to make sure it knows.
Yeah. I'm trying to perfect its algorithm for my taste.
I love it. It's learning. It's evolving. It makes me think of Spotify as like the Terminator. So where did, you know, at what point did learning how to play an instrument enter into the picture for you, and what type of music and what bands and stuff were you listening to at that time?
Oh, okay. So yeah, metal was there kind of first, but it was really overwhelming. Okay. Just the musicianship. Okay.
Yeah.
So I didn't consider it as something I could also do. I just kind of enjoyed it. I really – the imagery was first. It was my sister and my – like I said, my uncle, and I saw the Iron Maiden posters on their walls and the Metallica posters, and it was just – the imagery really got me at first. But I didn't, it was never like – I would just go in there and just look at those posters, especially the Somewhere in Time with Eddie, you know. Because my sister had like a 6-foot-tall poster of that on her wall. It almost went from floor to ceiling.
So much detail on those Derek Riggs paintings, too, where you can find, oh, there's a little cat over there, and, you know, just, like, stuff hidden. Yeah.
So I will stare at those, you know, when I was, like, 10 or whatever. So it wasn't so much the music yet, because the music was definitely scary, but it wasn't, like, you know, it was very intriguing to me. But then, I never considered trying to play metal. But then, of course, in the 90s, when the grunge movement kicked in and came around, And I heard how easy those guitar parts were.
Right.
All of a sudden, I was like, oh, now I can play guitar. If this is all it takes to be in a band, I can do that. And so I got a guitar. And then,
I just had an almost identical conversation with Derek from Sum 41, for Speak and Destroy, where he was talking about, loving Metallica and that exact same thing where, as a guitar player, the idea of doing that stuff was intimidating, and then he heard Nirvana and was like, "Oh,
well,
maybe
there
I
you go.
can do this." Yeah.
Yep, samesies over here. So, yeah, it wasn't as daunting. I was able to pick up and play Smells Like Teen Spirit or whatever. Or, and then after a couple of years of that, you realize, oh, okay, I could probably try some of this metal and then, up your game once you've got past the simple bar chords. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What were some of the first riffs you remember learning?
Metal or just in general?
In general.
Let's see, my first strumming pattern, just right hand, which is like the first day of me having a guitar. My guitar wasn't in tune, but I was doing Plush by Stone Temple Pilots.
Sick.
That da da da
Yeah.
da da da,
I love
So I
that
did
song.
that, and then I was like, oh, I gotta learn what the left hand does. And let's see. And then I learned the little dinky, stupid little. I mean, this is so corny. I cannot come up. I can't imagine writing this now and going, "Hey guys, I wrote a riff that's an intro to a song. Not only an intro to a song, but it's Today by Smashing Pumpkins. That little dee doo dee doo. That little big.
Yeah.
It's like it was so cool to me back then. I don't know if it was really that cool or if it was just like, okay, this is about as easy as it possibly can get.
Yeah.
So I'll learn that. But yeah, those are the things. And I had like a girlfriend, like my first girlfriend at the time. I think I was just trying to like, show her that I wasn't a complete idiot and I could do something,
My older brother showed me on because my older brother was a bass player. And he showed me the only thing I can play on a bass if you hand me one right now, still, is do 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 from the little Cliff Burton lick.
No, that's not bad at all. Yeah.
I mean, but it's literally, and it's just, it's like muscle memory, Like I don't know what I'm doing. My hands remember how to where my fingers should go to do that.
Oh yeah.
So you mentioned the Metallica posters, and so where did Metallica enter?
So my sister did something. She had notebook paper, and she just drew the logo about 40 different times. And then she would just kind of, I guess, I don't know if she was really much of an artist or not. It might have not even been her, because I don't think I ever saw her draw anything other than that. It might have been like a boyfriend drawing for her. But it would be the Metallica logo on notebook paper, like school notebook paper. And then it would be colored in with like spider webs. And then she just had those plastered all over one side of her wall. And so that's all I really even knew what that was. I thought it just took a word over and over again. And then my uncle moved down and he had like a little, what is it? A Nissan, like a little Nissan truck that he had slammed or lowered down to the ground with, it was red, it was lowered, it didn't have power steering, and it had like a camper on the back with subs all through it, okay?
Gnarly.
And like speak sub speakers or whatever. And he would play, rap or whatever in there, but he also listened to like a lot of punk and metal too. And then I remember hearing Metallica through that, and that's I was like, he'd just be driving me around. We'd go skateboarding or something like that. And then he's playing whatever, and I'd be listening and asking what was going on. And I think he was driving me and a friend around. And I remember the kid, just a little country kid, going, "Hey man, do you have any of that stuff by Metallica?" And then
Yeah.
my uncle Mike is like, "What?" And he's like, "Metallica, it's this cool band. You'd be into it." Like he's trying to, this 12-year-old kid is trying to tell my uncle
He's trying to
what
step
Metallica
up.
is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my uncle just started, of course, making fun of him and goes, "Dude, I have it right here." And he put it in. And of course, he wanted to blow our hair back with those subs and everything. So I'm basically, listening to Injustice for All. Something off of Injustice for All. I don't know what it was. just really loud in a little lowered pickup truck that was meant to be playing, like, you know, hip hop or something.
I picture this like your uncle is Todd and you and your friend are Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Check this
yeah, he'd
out.
Be hitting us and punching us all the time and knocking us over and all sorts of stuff.
You know what? In your friend's defense, back in that era, even, you know, a friend of mine likes to call it secret knowledge. You know, subcultural information was a lot of word of mouth and a lot of magazines and fanzines and, you know, buying a record because you liked the cover art or you saw someone sketched out the logo. So there would be times where you would hear yourself say Metallica because it's a word you'd only seen and read a million times, but didn't know anyone else who knew what it was. So no one had ever said it in front of you, you know, like,
yeah. I mean, hats off to that kid. I mean, his name was Chad. That was the kid's name. Hats off to Chad. You know, he at least was able to keep his, you know, finger on the pulse enough to even have heard of it, you know?
Yeah. It's part of like early reading skills and stuff too. Like I grew up reading comic books, and in X-Men comics, they would always talk about how Cyclops and Jean Grey had a psychic rapport. And I grew up reading that word all the time, knowing what it meant, but thinking it was pronounced rapport because I never heard anyone actually say it, you know, like, so cheers for trying.
I think
trying.
Metallica sounds better than Metallica, don't you think?
It does.
I think they went with the right, the right pronunciation.
It's one of those band names too, where, you know, I have this conversation, you know, recently even, when it comes to naming things, there are so many names that we take for granted because the brand and the identity of it overtook the actual word. Because in reality, you know, if you were trying to come up with it right now, Metallica would sound like a terrible band name for a metal band, you know, or Megadeth or, you know, Target, a store called Target. Like, why is it called Target? You know what I mean? But we just, the brand identities have overtaken it and overshadowed it to where we just associate it with that particular thing now. We don't really, I mean, Tool is a terrible band name, but I just think of it as Tool. I'm not really thinking about.
Oh, I think about that all the time. I'll still go back and think about how ridiculous Smashing Pumpkins or right. Pearl Jam is.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, I don't know. Some stuff still, like Pantera, sounds really cool to me.
Yeah, and it's like, did Pantera always sound cool? You know? Did Iron Maiden always sound cool? Like, I mean, Judas Priest.
Now,
I mean, there
Maiden
are some names.
Sounded cool. Yeah. You got to admit that always sounded awesome.
Yeah, Judas Priest was.
But I know
you
like
awesome.
Megadeth. Megadeth was cool then, but I can see how like if you named it now, it'd be kind of. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I had some hipster friends that would make fun of my Megadeth shirts and go like, "Oh, oodles of death, tons and tons of death."
Well, yeah, my wife Becky, she is a. The other day, sometimes I'll just be talking about something and she just starts either rolling her eyes or laughing at me because she has no idea. She's not a metalhead at all. And then she's like, "What was the name of that song title?" I'm like, "Covered with Sores. It's by Cannibal Corpse." And she just is like, "What? Covered with Sores? Get out of here." Like, "Oh, yeah, it's like an old Cannibal Corpse song."
And you're like, "Yeah, from the band that brought you such hits as Hammer Smash Face." And
yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Oh, man. It is. Yeah. It's secret knowledge, secret language. But yeah, I don't think about, you know, I think about Exodus as a badass band name, but I don't think about, you know, Exodus with, you know, it doesn't conjure the Bible to me. I just think of the band Exodus, you know, when I'm thinking about it, or Testament or, you know, I mean, a lot of, in Megadeth, I think is a badass name, but it's taken on the identity that the band has kind of put on it, which, you know, there's a nice correlation here with Demon Hunter, because I don't know that it's accurate to say that it was a joke name, but it was definitely, my understanding is it was definitely conjured in a conversation that consisted of, what's the, like, corniest, most on-the-nose, straight-up Christian metal band name we can come up with? And they were spitballing as a, you know, that part was a joke. And then someone said, "Demon Hunter," and they kind of laughed, and then they went, "Wait, it's actually kind of badass. Maybe that should be a band." But yeah, it's the same thing. It's like now I just think of Demon Hunter as the band.
Yeah, because you can start trying a little too hard. you know, especially with Christian metal, you start going down and you start, sometimes metalheads aren't, you know, say you get a group of them, they're just not the smartest guys, but you feel like they just started using a thesaurus to figure out scary, evil, heavy sounding words. And it can start to get a little ridiculous if it goes too far. So Demon Hunter definitely isn't getting ridiculous. You know what both those words are, and you know, yeah, it's more on the nose, but at least it's not trying too hard. I don't know, man. I'd have such anxiety if I had to come up with another band name right now. It's gotta be so hard.
I know. And then for Anthrax, I felt so bad for them when, the big Anthrax scare was happening because it was like all of a sudden, you know, I mean, gosh, and worst of all, ISIS, the band.
ISIS, yeah. I was about to say ISIS.
So screwed. I remember they changed their Facebook page from because they had like / ISIS, I think, and then they changed it to ISIS, the band.
You got people who named their kids ISIS.
Yeah.
Because what is it? ISIS? Isn't that a... like an old, I'm not sure. I really don't know, but I think it's like an old god or something like that from like some mythology or.
Yeah, no, totally.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's been plenty of people who've named their kids ISIS and then,
Yeah, I think it's a Greek goddess. I don't remember. Or Egyptian, maybe? I think Egyptian.
Yeah, I don't think Greek because I would definitely... You know, I would know more about it because I know quite a bit about Greek mythology.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was talking about Greek mythology just earlier today to myself. So, you know, that's how often I bring that up. But I think ISIS, Egyptian might sound right.
I appreciate talking to yourself once in a while. I realized.
I wasn't talking to myself. I was recording another podcast. So I brought it up. Yeah.
Well, a couple days ago, I actually said out loud to myself, I hate small talk. It was right after somebody had delivered something to my house and we'd had some small talk and I closed the door and I walked in my kitchen and I said out loud, I hate small talk.
I thought you were saying you hated small talk to yourself. Like you don't even want to have small talk with yourself.
Yeah. And that's the thing is I don't know that I hate the concept of it so much as I don't know that I just don't feel I'm particularly good at it. So it gets awkward for me real fast. So Metallica, that was your first encounter with Injustice for All. That was your first encounter with the logo, which I think speaks so much to the importance of a lot of classic metal band logos and how, you know, the mystique and the kind of invitation to the journey that they present when you first see them, you know. When did Metallica become something that was yours as opposed to something that was being, you know, foisted upon you?
So I started taking guitar lessons and, let's see. So I was taking guitar lessons and I had, you know, a girlfriend and then I think she went with me once to the lesson cause she was kind of maybe getting into guitar. And so, the guy teaching me lessons was, you know, maybe early 20s and just a, you know, kind of a, you know, kind of a, I guess a, like some kind of an older, trashy kind of guy, right? And he was, after the lesson, he was kind of sitting there piddling around. And then my girlfriend was just, you know, oohing over him. Just, wow. You know, she just thought he was so impressive. And I was like, man, this guy's like a dork, you know? And then, but he had that guitar. And she, I don't think she paid much attention to him at first. But then whenever he pulled out an acoustic guitar and started playing around, I saw her eyes light up. And I was like, oh, man. Well, I'm just gonna have to learn how to play this thing better. But so she's like, play Nothing Else Matters. And then so he started playing it, and I just saw how simple that was. It's like, dude, this guy is not even using his left hand, and he's playing Nothing Else Matters, and she is just like, you know, falling in love. I was like, I can do that, you know, and I know that that was Metallica. So then I was. But then again, I didn't know that metal could be that easy. I thought metal was only really, really difficult. I mean, the guy was probably teaching me a Green Day song or something like that right before, right? And then here I am seeing, no, Metallica can be, you know, it is accessible for me to play. I can play that now, especially since the dude's not even using his left hand yet. And then So I went home, and then I had a whole bunch of Guitar World magazines, and then there's all those tabs in the back. And,
yeah.
I was reading those wrong, by the way, for like the first year. I didn't know what tab was. I was reading the staff notes, and then I would just look up what note that was and then find it somewhere on the guitar, and then just – it took me 10 times longer.
To took do you 10 way. Times longer, but probably in some ways was better for you, right?
Cause
it probably,
no, because I never learned how to read music for real. I just knew how it worked.
Yeah.
But, you know, so yeah. Well, eventually I go, you know what? When I'm doing here on my guitar – looks an awful lot like what those notes are, those numbers are on those lines.
Yeah.
And then it all clicked. Like, no one ever told me that's what tab was. I just figured it out.
Again, secret knowledge. So, I mean, this was in an era where you couldn't go take guitar lessons on YouTube.
You know, like, yeah, you have to take it from some dude who's trying to steal your girlfriend. Yeah. So I learned, you know, I've quickly found Nothing Else Matters in some Guitar World magazine or something. And then, you know, I'm going to show her. She wasn't nearly as impressed with me playing it as she was dude, but that was okay. Now I can play this stuff. And then, so yeah. Started just kind of wearing that. Definitely the Black Album, started wearing that one out.
And that song is one of the rare Hetfield solos.
Mm-hmm. Which I can't play.
It seems tough. And it's a song that if I recall correctly, it wasn't even really intended to be a Metallica song. It was just kind of something he wrote in a hotel room or whatever, and then it ended up finding its way into that record. So would you say the Black Album was the first record of theirs that you really wore out, or was that just the first?
Yeah, that's what I started wearing out. Of course, going backwards to me was. It was great because at the time that was all that was there was the Black Album. If you wanted more, you know, if you're done with this, you don't have to wait for the next one. That's what's so cool about finding a band in the middle of their career.
Yeah.
You have back stuff to go, you know, you can go backwards and that stuff is not easy to digest. So you got, you know, a good year or two of digesting this stuff before whatever the next one comes out. You know what I'm saying?
That was something I loved about comic books. You know, when I got really into X-Men comics, I didn't have to just wait a month for the next issue. I could go to the comic book shop and buy back issues and get all caught up.
I still think
on
about just music in general is that I don't have to sit here and wait for something awesome. You know, oh man, nothing's really blowing my hair back these days. Dude, there is so much. You can go, I don't have to listen and wait around for new music. I can just go back and go, what was album of the year, or like rock album of the year in 1976? And just, it better be impressive because it was impressive enough to be the album of the year that year. And then you won't be disappointed for the most part.
Yeah. And, you know, to that point, obviously we're people that have made music our career and it's such a huge part of our lives and so on. And I'm an obsessive fan of so many things. I also recognize that there are things that I like that I still have yet to really, really dive into. Like I haven't had a Pink Floyd phase or a Beatles phase or a Stones phase. And those are all bands that I like. And I know the kind of signature songs and, you know, I'm certainly very aware of all of those bands and their impact and legacy, but I've never really, you know, gone through a period where I'm like, I'm one by one in chronological, the Pink Floyd catalog, you know, there's so much undiscovered country for me there. And I find that exciting. I'm actually
excited
that
we
still
have enough.
That. Yeah.
You know, we have enough. We don't have to keep, we can stop making music. Everyone could, you know, and then there's plenty to go back and still listen to. And I'm just thinking about my daughters who are six and, I mean, they can just dig into it. You know, they'll have so much by the time that they're really getting into it.
Yeah.
And hopefully they're just not listening. Hopefully I would have, you know, gotten them to just not rely on whatever the pop thing is that day. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They can, there's always something you can go back to. Movies too, but definitely books. Books usually hold up. Movies won't hold up as much because of like, you know, just what it is. Video, quality and hairstyles even. You know, you're watching like Star Wars or Empire Strikes Back, and then their hairstyle, their 70s hairstyle is really dated, you know, even though it's like a space movie. But, you know, of course that holds up, but there's other stuff that just won't hold up because the story might or whatever, but man, the effects. So, but look, you know, luckily music, you can kind of overlook that sort of thing with, you know, bad, you know, audio quality or whatever, as long as the songs are still there, you know what I mean?
And to your point about, you know, a band like Metallica, discovering them, you know, where you did on album 5 and having all those records to go back to, also, even if you've sort of exhausted that, there's, you know, Sideways across similar genres, there's stuff that's a little more extreme, and then there's also something I've always loved doing, which is reverse engineering and unpacking, you know, like, if someone's really into the band Him, it's so awesome to, like, show them Type O Negative, you know?
Yeah.
If they're really Type O Negative, show them Black Sabbath, you know, like...
Or, yeah, who influenced Metallica? Because you can sit there and you go, wow, I really like this band Metallica. So, you know, say I'm, like, go back to when I was 13 or whatever. Man, they have Motorhead shirts and Misfit shirts on... Oh, you know, that's what they're wearing. They're either wearing Metallica shirts or Motorhead or Misfits shirts.
That's how I discovered, of course, Misfits and Sam Hain was via them wearing those shirts.
You know? There you go. So you can kind of go backwards. And if those groups were good enough to influence this group that you really dig, then, you know, there's got to be something to that. You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
So, yeah, you can just keep getting influenced if you just keep going backwards. So, yeah, it did bum me out that when I hit Black Album, I was like, I wasn't going back. Oh, this older stuff isn't for me. This is like a different generation, or the recordings sound funny. And no, I don't ever look at it that way.
That brings up a great question. Where did your interest in producing and engineering and all of that develop?
So I was in a band that was like a pop punky, we won't even get into what we sounded like because it was just all over the map. We're that band that there was one dude that was into this, and one guy was into this, and one guy was into this.
I think those were the early bands that were cobbled together out of necessity. You know, yeah, it wasn't like, who are the best guys to play together? It's like, who do we know that plays anything?
Yeah, so we're going through that little phase. You know, we scrounge up $500 to go record somewhere in south of Houston in a little shack. It was like a storage shed that I remember it was painted bright pink on the outside, you know, along the Gulf Coast or whatever, just the beach communities, you'll have a lot of bright colored, you know, buildings, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was like a theme. So I remember it was bright pink with like teal trim. And we went in and it's a recording studio in there. So we paid this guy $500. He starts recording our dumb little band. And I wanted the kick drum to sound like No Effects and just that really snappy, high-end, clicky kick drum. So I was trying to tell the engineer, hey, man, make that sound like this. And I play it for him, and he kind of rolls his eyes. He's like, no, it sounds better like this. It sounded terrible. It was just like boom, boom, boom. It sounded like, you know, a marching bass drum for, like, you know, a marching band. And the guy thought he was nailing it. And I was like, I don't care what you think is a good kick drum. I want it to sound like this. So I watched his fingers and I watched him kind of turn knobs and push stuff around. And the console, I guess, could be a recording console, could be real intimidating to somebody, but it never really was to me. I kind of just got that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching him. And I was like, dude, I see that when he's turning that, that's the equalizer. He's able to EQ each individual thing, just like you would EQ your stereo, whatever. I was like, man, I could do this. So, you know, I would try to, like, start messing with his console whenever he'd be, like, get up to go get a drink or something like that. And basically, I just want to be like, hey, man, just move over and let me do this. But it's funny to think back because I'm, like, 14 or 15, you know, trying to tell this engineer to get out of his own, you know, chair so I can do it, who's never touched a console before. Sorry, my cough there. But, I just remember going, well, I'm not paying $500 for this guy to mess this up because I already know I can do what he's doing. I see what he's doing. I know what it takes. So I'll just start being the guy who does this. So my next step was just buy, you know, the first thing you should get, which is like a little 4-track recorder, and then just went from there. And I don't think I've paid to have anybody record me since then.
Wow. And what did you find yourself at that point? Because obviously, as a guitar player, you're, you know, listening for guitar and things like that, and learning songs that you like. Did you find yourself also starting to develop an ear towards production? And, you know, because it sounded like you already had a little bit of a handle at 14 on what your preferences were in terms of how things should sound. And, you know, did you start finding yourself learning more about, like, oh, who produced this album? Or, because I know there's some people who are really into music but never follow that thread, that could care less who the producer was on something. And then there's some people that, you know, that's a big deal to them, and they can name, you know, 10 records that some producer did.
Well, that was obvious whenever I knew I liked Black Album, and then I listened to the stuff before.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. That sounds different. Yeah.
It's the same exact dudes. Mm-hmm. Why does it sound drastically different?
Yeah.
I didn't say any of it was better or worse, but it definitely sounds different. So that was kind of just obvious. I always knew that who was doing it, who was behind the console. Even then, like, I'm sitting there like, well, if this guy mixes us, it's going to sound like, you know, junk. But if I mix it, like, as if I knew what I was doing, it would sound different. So definitely, I mean, it was apparent that whoever was behind the console had a huge part in what it sounded like in the end. So I think just it was kind of just obvious to me that the producer, you know, or whoever's working the controls was just as much as the sound as the band. But I didn't learn. So that was, you know, I was saying that was an obvious thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't learn, and I should have learned, but it took a long time, is just because you have that guy who did this, you know, just because you get Terry Date to mix your stuff, doesn't, you're not going to sound like Pantera.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
A lot of it's got to do with the players. Not a lot of it. It's a ton of it. Has to do with the players and the songs, man. I could have, I wanted that guy to sound, make it sound like NOFX. And even if I just go, all right, forget this guy, and drove right over to the dudes who did the NOFX records and went right to their studio, my band would not have sounded like them at all. So that was a lesson that took me a long time to learn. You know, you just get, you have to have it. You know what I'm saying? You got to have that sound already in you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember distinctly my older brother telling me, the first time I got asked to be in a band, to sing for a band, I was a freshman in high school, and it was my, you know, small group of metalhead friends. One played guitar, one played bass, one knew a drummer. The bass player, actually, I was in, ended up being in several bands with, and still a close friend that I, you know, text with almost every day. But anyway, in that very first band, it was like they had a couple of originals, but it was mostly covers. And they told me to learn. We did Sanitarium, For Whom the Bell Tolls, I'm Bored by Death Angel, a couple other things. And I remember telling my older brother that I got asked to, like, try out for a band, sing for a band. And, you know, I was sitting there listening to Master Puppets on my little boombox on cassette. And I distinctly remember my brother telling me, just so you know, because obviously I was intimidated and I was, you know, wanted to make a good impression and make sure, you know, hope I sounded cool and all that. And my brother was like, just so you know, when you get there, it's not going to sound like this. And I was like, yeah. What do you mean? And he was like, no matter how good your friends are at their instruments or whatever, like, it's not going to sound anything like what you're listening to right now on this boombox. It's going to be a whole different experience. And that was something I didn't understand until it actually happened. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, all of us in a room banging around together, this is a completely different thing. Even though it's the same songs, the same notes, this, you know, it could even be the same gear. It's just not the same. There's, yeah, and that was kind of my first real clue about, like, what production and performance and studios and all how that all really factors in.
Yeah, the audio quality, I mean, being a producer, you would think I care a whole lot about audio quality, but it's actually not even my top, you know, it's not a priority to me. for what makes an awesome album. And if I've gone back and looked at all my favorite records of whoever, I've done this plenty. I'm like, wow, man, these are all considered to have bad recording quality.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot of it's personality and vibe, you know?
Like, yes. That's so I've crucial. Found out that's what's important to me is the vibe and the song, you know? Just, I guess, the song itself. And even knowing that it came out of a certain time, you know, so my favorite record, if this is Metallica podcast, I might as well say what my favorite one of theirs is. Yeah, it wasn't the first one, but it's my favorite is Ride the Lightning. And that's just because some of my favorite songs and riffs are on that one.
That's my favorite Metallica album, and for the same reason.
So, let's see. My wedding day, 2012? Yeah. I got married in 2012, and then you know, whenever you walk into the reception, and then the guy says, "All right, now introducing for the first time, Jeremiah." You know,
yeah.
And then you walk in, and they play something—I don't know—some music. I've been to a bunch of weddings, and it's always something. And then they kind of walk in; they're introduced to the reception.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mine was For Whom the Bell Tolls. And that was like one of the only things I got to actually pick for my wedding was, you know, my wife picked the first song we danced to and what, you know, what she walked down the aisle to and all that stuff. I go, "Can I pick this?" And she's like, "Sure." And I picked that. She's like, "Oh, that's great." So, yeah, there's a video of my wife and I walking in, and it's For Whom the Bell Tolls. Okay. And then it cuts right into...
You're like, "Hey, it's got bells. It's like wedding bells."
And then it's funny because that the song plays in its entirety, and then it cuts into "Simple Man" by oh my god. Well, we didn't do the
"Simple Man" is Skinner, right?
Yeah, but I'm about to get in trouble. Well, she ain't gonna listen to this podcast. somebody covered it. I don't know who covered it, but it was a cover of Skinner's "Simple Man."
Male or female?
Female. Alison Krauss. Did she do it? Dude, I don't know, man. Oh man. Well, it don't matter because what does matter it was Metallica first.
Yeah, I just Googled it, and one of the artists that covered it was Screwdriver. I'm pretty sure he didn't. Yeah,
wasn't the Screwdriver version. No, hold on. I did not dance to that was my mother son dance. Well, that makes more sense.
Well, Simple Man?
Yeah, dude. Well, at least I knew what I walked out to. No, it was the mother son dance was Simple Man, and then there was definitely an Alison Krauss song. I think it was an old Waylon Jennings song that Alison Krauss did. That was our first dance. Which I can't remember.
Yeah, Simple Man, Shine Down, Government Mule, Deftones.
No, we definitely did the Skinnered version of Skinner.
You didn't do the Dangerous Toys version?
No, we did the Skinnered version for my mother son dance. I was trying to, I got them all mixed up, but there was a, it's all coming back. Yeah, there was a Waylon Jennings song that Alison Krauss did, but none of that mattered. I didn't pick any of that. Yeah, it's all cool stuff, but like I pick From the Bell Tolls. So anyway, go back to the production.
Hey, this ties us right into Metallica because that Alison Krauss Waylon Jennings cover appears on the Waylon Jennings tribute album, which also includes James Hetfield.
Yep.
We did it. We did it. Yay.
Yeah. I'm aware of that because yeah, my wife's got ties to the Waylon Jennings camp and band. Mm-hmm. Her parents were in his band throughout the outlaw years. So, you know, I hear plenty about Waylon. We're always doing Waylon tribute shows and all sorts of stuff, like going to those and watching her parents play them. And Becky's, she was the one who told me, you know, James Hetfield did something once. And I was like, what? And she showed it to me.
Yeah, one of the few James Hetfield solo things that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad that I had an opportunity to see Waylon Jennings, you know, because obviously he passed away in recent years. I got to see him on the second stage at Stagecoach And I want to say I saw him again.
About what year was that?
Probably 2010.
Oh, Waylon?
Yeah.
No, Waylon died like in 2001, I think.
Am I thinking? Oh, you know what? This, I'll edit myself. I'm thinking of Merle Haggard.
Okay. You know what? We could cut out everything from my wedding on.
We'll clean it up.
We just aren't remembering anything.
We'll clean it up. Yeah, I saw Merle Haggard at Stagecoach before he died, and then at his own show. Yeah, because he just died a couple years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
We're idiot. Hi, old men trying to remember things. A podcast. Yeah, so you mentioned Ride the Lightning's your favorite Metallica record. Do you let's talk favorite Metallica songs, favorite riffs. You know, give me some of your faves.
Creeping Death song and riff. Just the intro. It's got a strong intro. It's just crushing all the way through. I love how long it is.
Yeah, kind of becomes a different song at the end.
Yeah, it just keeps going, man, and it's just absolutely, it's got everything in it. And then so working backwards, that becomes my favorite record and so on. I mean, I was trying to get Creeping Death tattooed just down my forearm.
Mm-hmm.
And then a buddy of mine got it instead because he is just a jerk like that. I was working with him. He and I were screen printing t-shirts. It was just me and him at Zambui. And then he is completely covered all over the place. And I was talking about how I got this idea. And then he just was like, okay, cool. And then he just went and got it like a couple days later, just didn't even care. And I was like, well, okay, I'm not doing that. But then yeah. I was going to get the electric chair on my hand.
That'd be rad.
I thought that would look kind of cool. You know, if I'm playing guitar, it would have been on my right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then just like there's an electric chair right there, you know, right next. You can always see the top of the hand.
Yeah.
But I didn't do that. But, you know, I'm just, hey, I was thinking about it. You got to really like a record a whole lot in order to get the cover tattooed on your hand.
Yeah, totally. And that title track's got a little Dave Mustaine riff in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
We'll co-write. Ride the Lightning, the song.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, he's got a co-write on that song and on Call of Cthulhu on that record.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, see, now you learned something, too. I'm learning all about you, and now you just learned a little Metallica fact.
I'll keep it coming.
Yeah. So when did you first...
Well, hey, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Why is it Cthulhu? I know that's how they spelled it, but why isn't it Cthulhu?
Because they made a mistake.
See, I didn't know. Okay, that's a very simple answer, and I didn't think it was that simple. Because it's Cthulhu. You know, H.P. Lovecraft, it's Cthulhu. And then they were on there, it was Cthulhu, and I just never knew. Well, they're referencing the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, is this like a, I love Celtic music, or do you, I love the Boston Celtics? You know, Celtics. Some things just kind of like switch. You don't ever know why. And that was one of them.
And there's a, I think it's an urban legend. It sounds like a cool story. I'm pretty sure that they just screwed it up and have admitted as much. But there's a cool story that because in, you know, in the H.P. Lovecraft stuff, that writing out his name or saying his name will bring Cthulhu closer to you. So supposedly Metallica misspelled it on purpose to, you know, keep themselves from bringing Cthulhu.
To not have a death clock moment where they're playing that song live and then they summon Cthulhu.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Which would
obviously,
which is a great explanation. I mean, they should definitely go with that one. And and the song was originally called When Hell Freezes Over, back when Mustaine was in the band. And there's versions of When Hell Freezes Over floating around out there. I think demo versions. And I think Metallica's even released maybe in the collector's box for Ride the Lightning that came out. And then the instrumental on the latest Megadeth record, Dystopia, the instrumental on that song, to me, bears a lot of similarities to Call of Cthulhu. And it's kind of one of those chicken or egg things where it's like, well, I mean, you know, I guess you're allowed to kind of self-plagiarize, you know, like it makes sense that something you wrote will sound familiar and similar to something else you wrote. But I don't know. I just found that interesting when that record came out. I was like, this kind of reminds me of Call of Cthulhu. And then it's like, oh, well, that was a Mustaine co-write. So that's fair. Yeah. So when did you first see them live?
Load era. Load and Reload had come out. Cause so when I dug into them, you know, Black Album was there, but it wasn't, you know, I'm not going to concerts when I was 12, Metallica right. shows, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I didn't go to any concerts until that were like a big show. I was just going to like little death metal shows and punk shows that came through. There's this place called Fitzgerald's in Houston that just got torn down like 2 weeks ago, but that's where I saw those, you know, small bands. So I was going to that. I didn't get to go to that because that's where my uncle was dragging me to. You know, he's like kind of like in a scene. He's like in the skateboard scene. It never occurred to me that I could just go to a huge concert. But when Load and Reload had come out and they were touring for those, you know, I think there was even like I hear that they're not just playing all that new stuff because, you know, there was a lot of backlash against the Load and Reload stuff, but they're playing, you know, tons. So my buddies and I, oh, okay, we'll still go see them. And of course I loved it. But, you know, when you're like 17 and you're bummed about them having cut their hair, as if you should have anything to say, because myself, I didn't have any long hair. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was then, and I've probably seen them about 7 or 8 times since then, but it was always in the round. And the last time I saw them was a long time ago. So I was in Nashville, and I have this thing that metalheads, a lot of metalheads can do this. I look like a roadie. If I'm just walking around, I look like a roadie.
Yeah.
So what I did at the Bridgestone Arena here in Nashville, man, Patrick was with me, Patrick from the other guitar player from Demon Hunter. And we just rolled in to the Bridgestone Arena, just walked right in through the back, the loading dock and everything, just walked right on in and just kept walking and just walked past people. And then we walked right out onto the floor, didn't pay for anything. We just strolled right on in. And, you know, you just look like a roadie.
Yeah.
I mean, black shirts, black pants. Okay, we get it. You know, just don't wear all your cool studded belts and stuff like that. Don't stand out too much. But
well, and you also have to look like you're – I found that a good trick is to look like you're not all that excited about where you're going and that you're purposefully – you know, like don't look like you're sneaking in. You know,
I don't think I ever look like I'm excited. So
yeah, and
it's easy for me to do.
I've gone into Warped Tour so many times just by being older and looking like I couldn't be bothered. You know, or you know, or sometimes you know you get into a show by talking on your phone and you're just you know you're really busy and you're walking fast and you're heading into the production office. You just kind of have a look about you of like, do I look like I'm not supposed to be here? Because I am.
Yeah, so I've
looked like I'd be trying to sneak in. Yeah,
I've been doing that for a while, and I did that for this show. And so I remember Patrick and I kind of walked all the way down to the front, and then you know it was the round. And I remember going. I think I saw a microphone stand and a Marshall amp that kind of got wheeled out, and I was like, "That microphone stand, that's Lemmy. That's the way Lemmy sings because it was a 57-inch down."
Yeah,
and I was like. That is a very Lemmy thing to do. And then I saw them wheeling out the Marshall. I'm like, and he plays through a Marshall half stack. He plays bass to that. So Lemmy's here. We got to go over there. So we went over to that side, and then we were probably like just 10 feet in front of him. And then Lemmy came out and did a couple songs with him.
Insane.
And I remember he was like tied to that one corner.
Yep.
And his cord for his guitar or his bass was just stretched across, not even touching the stage. It was like so tight.
That's so awesome.
It was like so like.
He just got his exact rig from, you know, playing House of Blues two nights ago or whatever.
Yeah. And they're on this massive stage, and then the guys are running around. And he was just locked to that one little microphone.
Badass.
And so we, I think there's even a photo. I'll see if I can dig that up. But there's a photo of Patrick and I right there.
Oh, dude,
that's right in front of
Lemmy. If you can find that, that's for sure the one I'm using on social media to promote this episode.
Okay, I'll have to go way back in my Facebook, but if it's going to be anywhere, it'll be on that.
That's so badass.
So that was the last time I got to see him. I wish I saw him in this last little round, but I don't think I was in town.
Well, and to that point about, you know, getting into shows that you're not necessarily, quote-unquote, supposed to be at, I've also had situations where I have every credential necessary, but because I stopped and went, hey, does this get me back here? Am I supposed to go in here with this? I get stopped. Yeah. I get stopped in those situations. Those are the situations where whoa, hold on, buddy. Let me radio over here and blah, blah, blah. That's when I have the right stuff.
And well, how about even further than that? We got kicked out of our own backstage room, like we weren't supposed to be in there. That festival that we opened for Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, Chicago Open Air. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're opening up, we're on the main stage, like the third band on the main stage of that festival, and we are in our own little room.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so say we are in our own little room, and then they're like, you gotta get out of here, you're not supposed to be in here. Like, this is our dressing room.
Yeah, that's the ultimate. We are supposed to be here, and someone's telling us we can't be here. I forgot about that. Yeah, that dressing room was like right on the main stage. Like,
maybe that was karma getting us back for all the times I just walked past.
Totally. I remember one year I was going to Mayhem, and I was with Bill Fold, who's the festival director for Coachella and Stagecoach and a bunch of the big events out here. Good friend and mentor to me. And we did, full disclosure, we did have the right credentials and everything, but we hadn't picked them up yet, you know, and it's like, you got to go wherever you're supposed to go to do all that and whatever. And he just drove right, you know, through the back entrance to where all the buses were parked and has just this fistful of laminates from like a gazillion shows. It just looks like you're a champion holding up the severed head of Medusa or something. And he just like held all of these laminates up and, you know, irritatingly, like he's annoyed, you know, like held them up to every security guy and just drove past every checkpoint without ever stopping. Just like holding up a bunch of laminates. And people just kind of look at us like, okay, like, seems legit, I guess. And we just literally just pulled right up to the buses. So, probably shouldn't be giving this advice to listeners, but have at it, kids. Act like you belong there.
It's a good trick.
Yeah, because even if you do belong there and you don't act like you belong there.
But this is a little side story. I'm like 16. I got my truck. I'm able to drive. And I wanted to do audio production or whatever. So a buddy down the road, his dad owned a staging company and did all the big events at the local arena where the Houston Rockets played and all sorts of stuff. And so I worked with him a few times, but I got my backstage pass that was for that company because it's called Upstage in Houston. So I got an Upstage laminate with my photo on it. I'm 16. I look like I'm 12, but I have a photo. And it says, you know, it's a real backstage pass. And I worked a few events, you know, wrapping up cables or whatever. Bush and Garbage and maybe it was Goo Goo Dolls, but Bush and No Doubt and some other bands were on tour. And Bush was headlining. And I was like, oh, you know, I'll go see that show. I can get into that for free. So I drove by myself.
Does this seem like about 1996, maybe?
Yeah, because I was 16. For sure, I was 16. Have tried to do it.
That tour was Bush, No Doubt, and the Goo Goo Dolls. There you go.
Okay. So Goo Goo Dolls opening, or I don't know who was opening, but definitely Bush was headlining. And so I drove up there. drove my truck right next to the tour buses and just parked and just got out and walked in, flashed my, you know, pass a few times. They're like, yep, that's a legit pass. And it was the crew that I normally would work with. You know, well, let's say I worked with them like two times before that. That they were the staging crew for that show. So I walked in and then I just walked right into catering. And I remember seeing Gavin Rosdale macking on Gwen.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that was when they started dating, was via that tour.
So I was the first person to ever see them, dude. I could have broken that story if I had an iPhone.
You could have been the TMZ of 1996.
Yeah, I remember looking over, and it's catering, dude. They're sitting over there. There's, like, some band guys over there, some crew guys over there. They're, like, in the corner, like, definitely kind of just flirting, kind of snuggled up next to each other. And I was like, oh, that's the singer of that one band. You know,
yeah,
meaning,
the headliners at the time, yeah.
Well, I knew who Gavin was. I knew who the singer of
So you were looking at Gwen going, oh, that's the singer of
that band. Yeah, because I didn't listen to No Doubt or anything like that. Yeah. I was like, she's the singer of that other band.
I mean, and they were the support band, you know, to Bush. Yeah, I mean, Bush was a much bigger band at that time.
Yeah, so I just remember going, wow, you know, that's kind of neat. Just, I guess, if you know, there's a girl and a guy on tour that – sparks might fly, you know, kind of funny. And never occur to me. You know, I never thought of it past that. But then, of course, whatever, they were, I guess, a couple forever after that.
Well, I'm looking at No Doubt's tour dates from 1996. And
what day was it?
They were.
What day were they at the summit? It's called the summit.
I'll find that. But I'll tell you, before that tour, I assume these were No Doubt headlining shows. They played The Catalyst in Santa Cruz. The Phoenix Theater in Petaluma, and two shows at the Glass House in Pomona. Those are all, you know, to give people the idea, those are the same venues that, like, Demon Hunter is playing in 2019. So if that gives you an idea of, like, how big No Doubt was at that time.
Or how big we're going to be 20 years from now after I start dating a dude from Bush.
Yeah, let me look. I'm looking for Texas. Remember, was that like summertime? They played a lot of shows that year.
Every day feels like summertime in Houston, Texas.
True. Let's see.
But I did drive by myself. I did that quite a bit. I went to several shows. I would just full on drive up completely by myself. I saw Rush. They were doing a test for Echoes. That was that record that just came out. And they're supporting that tour. And it was just a big, long 3.5 hour show of Rush.
The Summit, was that the venue?
Yeah, the Summit. That's where that was the original arena name. That's like where the Rockets played.
And it was March 31st, 1996.
Yeah. Dude, so that was like a few – I just got my driver's license. That's what it was. I just turned 16 like a few days before that.
Nice.
So here I am. I just drive straight into the heart of Houston, Texas from this small town – just by myself, and just
that's great. That's kind of kid. That's great, by the way, that you have the you can do the math where you're like, you were 16 in 96, 17 in 97.
Yeah,
and I can do the same thing with grades because I was in second grade in 82, third grade in 83, like all the way up to, you know, senior year was 92. So I can remember that. Otherwise, it would take me 10 minutes to remember what year I was in what grade.
So the reverse for me, I have no idea what age I was and what grade. So,
yeah, but you can do the year and your age.
Yeah,
that's fun. So yeah, so a couple more Metallica things.
Mm-hmm.
What in your mind has, and obviously there's a million answers to this, and no one is more correct than any other. But what in your mind are some of the reasons that they've had so much staying power and that they've been, you know, they're still one of the biggest bands in the world where a lot of their contemporaries, you know, I mean, it's such lightning in a bottle. And obviously the Black Album was, you know, put them far ahead of most metal and rock bands and still sells 3,000-4,000 copies in America a week at a time when no records sell. You know, biggest album of the SoundScan era. What do you think it is about Metallica in particular that's made them continue to be so relevant? Yeah.
I may have pondered this a little bit, I could start accessing some of it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have to think too hard about it, but obviously a lot of things. Let's go ahead and just say one, you know, management.
Mm.
Keep them in line. Management is good for all, because they've had some bad moments there. And management, as far as I understand, really worked hard to keep everything flowing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I would argue also the consistency of that management, because you know I've kind of broken it down before where I look at the big four and you look at the billing, right, where it was like Metallica clearly at the top, and then Slayer and Megadeth pretty neck and neck, but the way it shook out was Slayer, then Megadeth, then Anthrax. And if you look at the organizations and the lineups, you know, I look at the very top and I go, Metallica's had the same management since Q Prime came on board with them. They had the same record label, you know, going from Megaforce to Elektra, and then their own, you know, and lineup changes from Kill 'Em All onwards, you know, there's really been very few. And obviously one of them, you know, tragically was because of death. And then you go down and it's like, okay, Slayer's had pretty much the same management from back in the day. At the time of the Big Four shows, they had their original lineup back. And then you go down to Megadeth, and it's like, okay, you had Mustaine and Ellefson as like the key anchors, but then a lot of guitar players, a lot of drummers, a lot of managers, a lot of record labels. And then Anthrax, at the bottom of the bill, has had the most singers, the most record yeah. labels, the most managers. So I kind of look at that. Obviously, it's not the crucial thing, but I think one crucial thing is the consistency of the team around
yeah,
them.
It can't be, oh, Anthrax is, you know, Scott Ian and Dan Pitts, or, you know, Dan Pitts back in the day, right?
Yeah.
Is that his name? Yeah, it's not, so it wasn't just that. It starts forming into different things. It's like, oh, Megadeth isn't just, you know, Mustaine. It's got to be a lot of things. So I feel like Metallica isn't just James Hetfield and Ulrich, you know, it's
right.
the other guys. And then it's the management, it's the label, and it's all the other things that makes them what they were. It's that their past, it's their, you know, their past works, their records they've done. It's not just, well, it's just one guy. As long as we have yeah. just that one guy, it's going to be there. So I think, yeah, I would say go ahead, management obviously helps a lot. Especially like they said, the staying power of it. But then, the other thing I think about a lot is when you do your record, you got to do your record that you want to do. You can't chase, trends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess you could, but like I don't know if you should. There's just no staying power in that at all. let's say if you chased, if we were chasing trends back in the day, we'd have turntables,
right?
You know,
right.
And then, or any of my other bands, or then we're chasing. I think about Motley Crue with this.
Yeah,
I feel like they're really trying to chase trends, especially Tommy Lee. Tommy Lee had his own solo project, and the dude wanted to sound like Third Eye Blind for like a year.
Yep.
You know,
and then he had his rap metal. Fred Durst is in my video, and then And he wanted to be an EDM DJ recently.
Yeah. So he is like the biggest example I can come up with. Like, see what happens when you chase trends. You just, you got to do what was you. You got to do what you wanted to do. And I felt like they're making the records.
Sorry, we were talking about logos, and you think about, you know, with only slight modifications, that iconic Metallica logo, the iconic Slayer logo. And yeah, Motley Crue had a different logo on every record. It's like, I don't think that's a good idea, you know, like, when it comes to, that consists. Yeah. And then, like you said, of course, you know, the John Corabi record was their attempt to go grunge, and, you know, they threw MTV out of the interview because they were asking about Hairspray or something like that, you know, and it's like, well, you guys were the Hairspray guys like 5 minutes ago. Yeah. Can't be mad about that.
So here's a Jerem analogy for you. So what if Starbucks, their logo evolves?
Right.
But it's the Starbucks logo, right? Yeah. What if all of a sudden they're like, man, we dropped a few points. What's big right now? And everyone's like, oh, Apple computers, and then they all of a sudden just like copy the Apple computer or try to do something that looks like an Apple computer. All of a sudden, all the Starbucks get changed and they look like Mac stores or whatever, right? You know what I mean? It's like chasing some trend. No, man, you got to just do your thing.
And you can evolve creatively and change with the times. I mean, yeah, like, you know, it was a big deal when Metallica cut their hair. And I remember saying to my friends at the time, well, we all cut our hair.
But did they cut their hair because they were trying to, they felt like they're being outdated and they want to fit in with the times, or did they cut their hair because they wanted to? That's the difference.
Exactly. And I think that's the big thing with Metallica. I think they cut their hair because they wanted to. Yeah.
They definitely wanted to. You know, I bet you they had people tell them not to do that.
Totally.
So, like, to think that they're trying to, I don't think they've ever been accused of, like, oh, they're just trying to, like, jump, you know, on the bandwagon of whatever things look cool now, this grunge thing. I don't think they would have been trying to do that. I think they just really wanted, to cut their hair and just kind of hang out.
Yeah, and that's always been my argument. Like, when they made Load and Reload, you know, for anyone who thinks that era was selling out, to me, I go, well, they loved Alice in Chains at the time. They're really inspired by what Alice in Chains and Soundgarden were doing. And they have always loved Led Zeppelin and Skinner and Thin Lizzy. And I think at a time when they're listening to all of the above stuff and they're not 18-year-olds in a garage with acne and ripped up jeans, I think it would have been selling out and fake to pretend that they were 1985 Metallica instead of 1995 Metallica. You know, I think they were true to who and what they were at that time. And, you know, you can evolve in that sense. And, you know, I think they were the first band that really, at least for me, for my experience as a fan, that really cemented that idea of we do what we do for ourselves first. And if other people like that and the mainstream comes to us, great. But we're not going to do things for other people. And I feel like before that, rock bands were very much the, you know, we do this for the fans and we want to give the fans what they want and the fans this and the fans that. And Metallica loves their fans and has been very more fan friendly than most. But that idea though, that the artistic side of it, the creative side of it, you're pleasing yourself as an artist first. And everything kind of coalesces around that. I feel like Metallica really pioneered that, at least in the mainstream, as far as an ethos and something that became more acceptable. You know, and I think paved the way for a Nirvana and for bands that you know, carried that torch forward.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it was just them going, well, it makes good business sense for us to just do what we want, or if it was just ego, but it worked. You know what I mean? Yeah. They just kind of followed their heart at that point and just maybe they didn't care about money. Maybe it wasn't – they weren't trying to make a good business decision. They just wanted to make what made them sane, which is do the music they wanted, you know?
Yeah.
But it – I mean, it works. You know, if you do the music that's true to yourself, you know, there's something to be said for that. And then I guess the sort of management and then just them wanting to doing the music that they want to do, I guess the third thing I would think that really helped out is they spent time. I mean, these records weren't cranked out every 6 months or every year. They, recording Black Album is a masterpiece because they worked on it. And, if I work on a record now, and I get this a lot, bands want to record with me, and they ask me, well, how much to do a record? And I'll say, how much? And then they'll say, well, that's a lot. I'm like, well, if you want to sound like this, a good record, this it takes time. But if you want it to sound like a demo, which was, it sounds like to me, you just want to come in and record an entire album in 3 days, it's going to be a demo. You want to put that on the shelf and be proud of that? You know, just think about how many years or weeks or months it took you to write these 12 songs and then get the ability to play them and then find all the players. And you just want to crank them out in 3 days. You know, it's not going to sound as good as if it could have been like worked on and just, you know, scrutinized over. And they definitely did that on that record. And it shows as to where even today they're still. People still talk about those sounds.
Yeah.
And they still make, no, I don't know if they make money, but the people involved in making that record are making money off it. Bob Rock can still sell the Bob Rock drum pack. And yeah. it just keeps getting repackaged and repackaged. You know, Toontrack will sell the Superior Drummer program. And then one of their presets is like a Black Album preset. It was, you know, made and designed by Bob Rock himself. He's still like getting asked.
You know, I remember one of my favorite stories, our mutual friend CeCe from Blackville told me when they did a record with Bob Rock that Bob was asking him, like, so what kind of, you know, drum sounds do you like? What are some of your favorite records and what kind of tones you want to go for? Yeah. And CeCe was just like, the Black Album?
Yeah. That's why we hired you man.
Dr. Feelgood? Like, those will work? Like, I like those drum sounds.
Yeah, what you do, what you got, that's why we have you. That's why we're trying to get you to get what you got before, but get it for us.
Totally.
Yeah. I love talking to CeCe about that because, you know, I knew he was – I was excited for them to go track with Bob Rock. I was like, dude, y'all got to come back and, you know, let me in on some you know, details.
Yeah.
So that's
I think
cool.
It was really exciting for him and Jake in particular to be with a producer that you know, a lot of producers kind of in their genre are about the vocal melody and you know, that side of it, which is his own, you know, I'm not saying one's better or one's worse, but for them to go work with Bob, who's like riff and kick drum. That's the foundation. I think that was really exciting for those two guys in particular to get to experience that.
Yeah. Cause he gets it. I mean, I think I saw like a video of them in the studio with Bob Rock and they're doing drums. And I knew that CeCe had he had to just kind of play the parts in the previous records. But in this one, he walked in and he was so excited because CeCe's an amazing metal drummer.
Yeah.
And I knew that. And I worked with him for quite a bit. And I knew he was going to do nothing but impress Bob, you know, in the studio. And I was just excited for that because normally a crazy, awesome drummer like that is getting kind of like nerfed a little bit in the studio because you got to just kind of let the song breathe. But I could just hear on that record that Bob's like, nah, man, just do your thing. This is crazy. You're coming with awesome stuff. And then I think Bobby, you could just really see the joy in his face watching CeCe play drums. Plus the dude's such a wild, fun, wacky character.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was just kind of fun to have around in the studio.
Yeah. He's
not Bob, but CeCe is a wild, wacky character.
Yes.
So I'm sure he really cracked Bob up quite a bit.
Yeah. And CeCe is a future Speak and Destroy guest for sure. So I'm digging all of his Bob Rock stories.
Yeah. Love that dude.
That does it for my conversation with Jeremiah Scott of the band Demon Hunter. You can keep up with all things Demon Hunter at demonhunter.net and blessedresistance.com. I want to thank everybody for the support of Speak and Destroy. It means the world. There are a lot of you listening in lots of different parts of the world, and that is badass and killer. What I would like to ask you to do, and you know it's coming, please, if you're listening via some sort of Apple device, an Apple podcast, go in and write a nice little review and leave a 5-star rating. I promise those really help with visibility and people discovering the podcast. There are a lot more of you listening than there are people who've written reviews. If you've written a review and left a 5-star rating already, thank you. If you haven't, please do so. I mean, you could do it right now. If you made it to this outro, I mean, you know, it's a few extra, what, 30 seconds, a minute? I don't know. Should I give people something? I'll figure that out. Maybe I'll offer some sort of incentive. Although right now it'd be nice if you just did it out of, you know, your love of the podcast and the kindness of your Metallica heart. Check out previous episodes with guests like M. Shadows of Avenged Sevenfold, Rob Flynn of Machine Head, Rob Halford of Judas Priest, Lizzie Hale of Hailstorm, Gary Holt of Exodus and Slayer, David Ellefson of Megadeth, and many, many more. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Check out our other podcasts, No Prize from God, featuring conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. Episodes include interviews with Jeremiah Scott's bandmate, Ryan Clark, vocalist of Demon Hunter, Tim McTagg from Under Oath, Satir from Satyricon, Dwid Hellion of Integrity, Sister Kate of the Sisters of the Valley, aka the Weed Nuns, and many, many more. Hoosier Illusion is a new podcast I do with my buddy Neil, where we get real deep about mental health. And there is Pop Curse, the podcast. Pop culture is a blessing and a curse. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, on Instagram at Superhero HQ. You can keep up with the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And as always, you guys have been great. And I've been Ryan J. Downey.